for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. President Bush said yesterday, a strong dollar is in our nation's interest. Most would agree, but unfortunately, that's not what we have. Some blame the dollar's decline for the run-up of both oil and food prices, and for the enormous transfer of wealth from the U.S. to the rest of the world. Joining me to talk about the value of the dollar and its impact on our economy, Ted Truman of the Peterson Institute of International Economics. He's former Assistant Secretary of the U.S. Treasury. Michael Greenberger is professor at the University of Maryland Law School and a former director of the Commodity Futures Trading Commission. Joining us by phone from Chatham, Massachusetts, is Greg Ipp of the Wall Street Journal. And throughout the hour, I'll be interested in your questions, comments. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send your email to drshow@wamu.org. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Greg, if I could start with you. In a speech last night, Fed Chair Ben Bernanke said the latest round of energy price increases have added to the risk of inflation. Is an interest rate increase even a remote possibility at this point?
Diane, I don't think we have an interest rate increase in the cards in the next few months. But that said, what I think Fed Chairman Bernanke has told us in his last few speeches in the last 2 weeks, both last night and a week ago, is that the risks are changing in the direction that inflation is more of a concern than it used to be. And while inflation, while interest rate increases were off the table as recently as April, they are no longer off the table. I think that he will be watching carefully to see if this latest run-up in oil and gasoline prices starts to trigger a more widespread inflation psychology in the country, where you see workers and firms trying harder to raise prices and wages. And that is something that could, in fact, bring about an interest rate increase before the end of the year. The evidence isn't there yet, but I think that the risks are definitely tilting in that direction.
Ted Truman, risks tilting in that direction?
I think definitely they're tilting in that direction, and in some sense the Federal Reserve has been playing, finds itself playing catch-up ball, in the sense that the global inflation problem is much worse than people thought that way were. It was, and as a consequence, even if the U.S. economy slows down, that the global economy is not slowing down so much, and that is continuing to put lots of pressure on inflation around the world.
What are the signs that global inflation is growing?
Well, in every country around the world, inflation is rising, right? Particularly in Asia, but in the Middle East countries, in Europe, that's the point about the European Central Bank is going to perhaps raise it. Looks like it'll raise interest rates as soon as July, this next meeting. We have a problem with global demand is outstripping supply, and I think that's the basic problem. And the Federal Reserve maybe was counting on more of a global downturn than has occurred, right, to provide slack around the world, right, not just in the economy with the U.S. recession.
Michael Greenberger, how do you see it?
I think the Fed chair is caught in a terrific bind. We are still in the liquidity crisis as a result of the subprime meltdown. There is limited borrowing and a lack of trust among financial institutions. That drove interest rates down to create liquidity in the market. Now we're confronted, that problem has not been solved, but we're confronted with inflationary commodity prices. Your listeners know by filling up their tank, gas prices are going through the roof, food prices are going through the roof. Starbucks, a cup of coffee is going through the roof. So he's if he raises interest rates, he hurts liquidity. If he keeps interest rates low, he hurts inflation. My own view is we got into this mess because of malpractices committed by the Bush administration. Both sides of this problem could have been stopped by deft handling by the Bush administration. Instead, they played into the hand of the markets, and they've been manipulated into this bind, and the American consumer is going to suffer.
Let me ask you about a statement that Paul Volcker made just a few weeks ago, Michael Greenberger, when he said the dollar, he said the world is in a dollar crisis. What does that mean, and to what extent do you agree with him?
Well, when the country is being hit by a double bind, money is illiquid and prices are rising. Bridges are collapsing. Cranes are falling down. We're in danger of the dollar losing its worldwide top reputation, which has been absolutely critical to the United States.
Explain how the value of the dollar is actually determined.
Well, I'm not an economist, but I'll give you my layman's view.
Fine. That's what we'd like.
The value of the dollar is in the crisis because this country began a subprime meltdown. We have paper floating around that was originated in this country that's valueless. The Fed is taking that paper as collateral and giving banks who couldn't use that paper for any other purpose, treasury bills. The United States taxpayer has accepted that collateral. Gas prices are going through the roof. Farm prices are going through the roof. The global climate is not being brought under control. Bridges are collapsing. Our infrastructure is in terrible shape. We're not a leader anymore. Now, is this a hopeless situation? No.
Ted Truman. Hold on, Greg. Hold on.
I think the point that Paul Volcker was making, and I once worked for him with him, so I can can't completely read his mind, was that we have the one international currency. And therefore, the bind that Michael was referring to, we are in, is that we can't just pay attention to what's going on in the domestic economy. We have to pay attention to the dollar in the world as a whole, right? And that's where you get a second dimension of this bind, right? We can't afford to ignore what's going on with the dollar. And the statements by the Secretary of Treasury and the President yesterday and Bernanke and Tim Geithner yesterday all were in various degrees, some better than others in my opinion, reflecting that reality that we cannot go off and sort of mind our own business or repair our own roads and ignore what's happening to the dollar in the international financial markets, because it could snowball in a way that makes things much, much worse.
Greg Ipp.
Yeah, I just wanted to clarify. Paul Volcker did not actually say that we're in a dollar crisis. He said we're in a financial crisis, which was not a controversial statement because he was referring to the general dysfunctionality that was going on in our banking and financial system. He is worried about the dollar, but I think as Ted would tell you, who worked on many serious currency crises in the late 1990s, what we have going on in the U.S. dollar right now is probably not remotely like anything that we would characterize as a currency crisis. We are not seeing investors, either domestic or foreign, dumping U.S. stocks and bonds wholesale because they are trying to reduce their exposure to the dollar. That said, you cannot be complacent about the possibility of something like that might happen. And because there's been a perception in the last few years that the U.S. has a policy of benign neglect towards the dollar, i.e. we would like to see it go down because that's good for trade, there is a fear that could become self-fulfilling. And echoing what Ted said, I think you have seen the Treasury Secretary, the President, the Federal Reserve Chairman, and the New York Fed President try to basically disabuse people of that notion because they realize that while we are not in a sort of self-feeding downward spiral in the dollar right now, in fact, it's actually up since its low points in the spring, you cannot exclude that possibility.
Michael Greenberger.
Well, I disagree with this theory. I believe that the Secretary of the Treasury and the President and Bernanke are blowing hot air. The only person I'm prepared to give some credit to is Mr. Geithner, the President of the New York Fed, who yesterday finally said, we have to get our house in order by controlling these complex derivatives, which were at the heart of the meltdown. I might add that all these people in February of 2007 were saying we didn't need to do anything about these derivatives because there would be market discipline. Market discipline led Bear Stearns into its collapse. Bear Stearns was taken over by J.P. Morgan to a limited extent, but $29 billion of their obligation is now our responsibility. Those were bad bets that Bear Stearns made. And my view is when you have Bear Stearns collapsing, Lehman Brothers holding on by its fingertips, all these monoline insurance companies, MBIA, that insured all this stuff are holding on by their fingertips, our roads are potholes. You cannot tell me that does not have an effect on the dollar.
Ted Truman, how worried should ordinary Americans be about the financial health of Bear Stearns, Lehman Brothers, and the banks, this country's investment and commercial banks?
Well, the financial system, I mean the banking system, what the ordinary Americans deal with is a bank that helps them make transactions and facilitate financial transactions. Though they're that level, they don't need to worry. The people who need to worry are the people who have invested in these institutions, not invested their deposits in the institutions, which everybody does,
but
right?
But suppose Lehman Brothers did go down. The Fed helped Bear Stearns. Can it afford to help Lehman Brothers?
Well, I don't know the facts of the matter with respect to Lehman Brothers. I think it was a close call with respect to Lehman Brothers, with respect to Bear Stearns. And my guess is that there's a better chance that Lehman Brothers would be let go because it would be, in fact, less of a shock to the market the second time around. It was the shock effect that they were worried about in the Bear Stearns, and they had to create a new facility in order to deal with it.
Ted Truman, he's with the Peterson Institute of International Economics. Do join us, 800-433-8850. I look forward to your questions and comments. That's the number to call if you'd like to join us. Questions, comments, and Ray sent an email saying, George Soros recently said on your program that the U.S. has experienced a super bubble for the past 25 years due to interest rates being held too low for too long, resulting in inflation of asset values, including housing. Do your guests believe this is true? And what is the current Fed funds rate in relation to the rate of inflation? What should it be? Ted Truman.
Well, I'm not sure I would go so far as a super bubble, but I think there is, in retrospect, there is a lot that monetary authorities, both in the United States and around the world, have to explain for themselves. Interest rates were, at least in the last 4 or 5 years, too low for too long. Whether they're too low for too long for the last 20 years is a different proposition. But I think, in retrospect, monetary policy, both here in Japan and in Europe, has fed the credit boom that we've had. That might have been able to be held off by regulation and some of the problems, but in any case, we've had a credit boom. And with the federal funds rate at 2% and the inflation at 4%, then you have a negative short-term real interest rate. In general, except for exceptional periods, short-term interest rates should be positive.
And Michael Greenberger, a super bubble.
Well, yes, a super bubble. And in fact, George Soros, a week ago today, he and I both testified to the Senate Energy Committee. And he is of the view, for example, with regard to crude oil, that we are in a classic bubble, a speculative bubble. I know
How much of today's current oil prices is due to speculation? I have heard as much as 25%.
Well, first of all, I want to say it's hard to tell because the critical parts of these markets were deregulated and are opaque, and nobody knows what's going on. That was inconsistent with long-term futures regulation. Yesterday, the president of OPEC said crude oil should be at $70 a barrel. 2 weeks ago, ExxonMobil said it should be between 50 and 55. Sunoco said it should be between 35 and 65.
So I don't understand what it is they're saying.
Well, they're saying that they think the market, and there's clearly a supply-demand problem. I don't want to say there isn't, and it's aggravated by our need to have clean energy, which will make energy more expensive. But what they're saying is take all that into account. There's a premium we are paying to speculators in dark markets who are using classic malpractices to drive up the price of crude oil beyond what supply-demand would dictate.
Malpractices, Greg Ipp.
Diane, it's very difficult to actually find the persuasive evidence that the markets are being manipulated. There is speculation going on, but speculation is not the same as manipulation. Somebody who speculates that the price of oil is going higher and therefore buys oil is only going to profit if he's right because fundamental factors back him up. And even then, if you thought that a lot of the rise in oil was because of this kind of speculative buying, well, those people would have to put the oil somewhere, and yet we do not see evidence of extraordinarily large inventories. If anything, inventories of oil product seem to be a bit on the lean side. Does speculation play some part? Possibly, but the economists who have looked at this issue the most carefully believe that it is predominantly because of very strong demand in countries like India and China, countries that, by the way, often subsidize the price of fuel, and so their consumers are often insulated from this impact, and because of diminishing supply. And in particular, one of the factors that we've learned in the last year is that many of the world's most important producing oil fields, whether it's in the North Sea, Alaska's Prudhoe Bay, the Gulf of Mexico, or eastern Saudi Arabia, these are reaching a stage of maturity where it is getting increasingly difficult to extract additional oil, and the new fields that are being discovered are 10 to 15 years away from delivering oil.
Now, we've got lots of callers, and I want to get them into this conversation as quickly as we can, because like me, they have a great many questions. And let's start first in Lake City, Florida. Good morning, Bill.
Hey, Diane.
Hi there. Go right
ahead. How
are
you today?
I'm fine, thanks, sir. Go right ahead.
Diane, I don't have a question. I'm just like you looking for answers. And today on your program, even you sound frustrated because you have this panel on today that seems just as confused as you and I are. I mean, the only difference that they seem to have more knowledge than you or I do is just that they're more articulate at speaking and being on your program than I do. But they're not coming up with any answers. If the answers, you know, it seemed like we can boil this down to something in simpler form. If the problem is that Bush never vetoed anything and signed too many checks, well, then say that's the problem. But just don't say it's Bush's fault or some speculator.
Well, you know, maybe the problem is that I am not asking the right questions to get you and me the answers that we need. For example, what is the connection between the Federal Reserve's decision to lower interest rates and the rise in food and oil prices? Ted Truman.
Well, the answer is there's not much, connection between? I mean, there is connection in the immediate lowering of interest rates in the last period that has no very little connection between that. I mean, it makes it slightly cheaper to borrow money to speculate, if you want to put it that way, but take positions. But
so
I think,
you don't see any connection.
I don't think the question is whether they didn't raise interest rates high enough before all this happened, right, and soon enough. That's the George Soros' point. And whether in lowering interest rates, as they have done over the last 6 months, they've gone too far and will have to reverse course and jerk things around. But I think, speaking to your questioner's comments, Bill's comments, the problem is maybe we are confused, if I put it that way, but the but there is a confluence of a large number of chickens are coming home to roost at the same time, and we don't have a single solution to deal with the multiple problems that we have in food, in energy, in inflation in general, in housing, in lack of regulation of the financial markets. And so there's no one thing one could do and say, well, we'll get out of this. And some of the things we do work at cross purposes.
Michael Greenberger, you don't look confused.
I don't feel confused. I think with regard to oil prices, I was in the offices of six senators yesterday. Both Democrats and Republicans.
Who?
Senator Lieberman, Senator Grassley, Senator Cardin, Senator Cantwell, Senator Sanders, Senator Pryor. I think the Soros testimony has convinced them that there is manipulation going on in energy futures markets. I regulated those markets. If they're unpoliced, you are at the mercy of the people who are manipulating.
And you're arguing right now that those markets have been unpoliced for too long.
Not only have they been unpoliced, but that we have companies in the United States who are trading 30% of the West Texas Intermediate crude oil, which is the determinant for what we pay for gasoline, heating oil, and everything else. And the CFTC has decided that company should be regulated by the United Kingdom rather than it.
Why?
Because a staff in 1999 wrote a letter saying that's what should be done. Legislation is being read.
Which staff?
The staff of the Commodity Futures Trading.
Why would they write such a letter?
Well, it's a long story about why, but there's a convincing in Congress now, bipartisan, that letter, which could be revoked this afternoon and bring all that regulation under American observation and control. It's a staff letter that can be terminated at will. Legislation is being readied to revoke those letters and bring these companies under United States regulation. And just let me add that the New York Mercantile Exchange has entered into a joint venture with the Dubai Mercantile Exchange. Dubai has been given permission to trade West Texas Intermediate in the United States and be regulated by the Dubai regulators. The CFTC has found that Dubai will regulate better than it will regulate. So when you see crude oil prices going up, the question is, do you want to investigate whether speculators have any role? Right now, the people who are investigating that are the United Kingdom and the Dubai government.
So in response to an email here from Jim, who says, I don't really understand much about the commodities market, but is it true to say that rich investors speculating that the price of oil would go up are causing the price to climb? In other words, wealthy investors are making money on the backs of the general public and causing our gas prices to go up. How do you answer that question?
The answer is yes, and they're doing it in markets that the United States government has agreed it won't police. The farmers understood at the turn of the 20th century that when they went to Chicago to hedge their farm prices, speculators could destroy those markets. Speculators have to be in the markets, but they've always been policed. Now, 30% of the West Texas Intermediate trades in the United States are not policed. And who are the big traders? Morgan Stanley, Goldman Sachs, British Petroleum. And there's been talk about, oh, they'd go out and buy if they could manipulate, they'd buy the underlying. Morgan Stanley.
What's buy the underlying? Buy,
if they're speculating in heating oil futures, they would buy heating oil. Morgan Stanley owns more heating oil than any other institution in New England as we speak.
Ted Truman.
Well, I think I don't want to go too far. I mean, I think that ultimately, as Greg Ipp said earlier in the program, their supply and demand will work itself out. So I'm sure it is profitable.
You have faith that supply and demand...
Well, no, there'll be a lot of problems. I have faith because I'm an economist, if I may put it that way. I have to believe my discipline. But the problem is, so ultimately, things will have to match up. So if people are betting on higher prices, right, and as long as the prices keep going up, they'll continue to bet on higher prices. And that, but as Greg said earlier, ultimately, it's going to be the demand has to match that supply.
But
and
why should the market that is making this kind of money control where those prices go at the cost of the ordinary Americans who are paying for this?
The question is, what is the alternative? And as Michael just said...
Regulation.
Didn't say full regulation. He said there's a role. He said very carefully there's a role for speculators
what
in all,
are
the,
you
all
saying,
these markets.
Michael Greenberger?
But they have to be supervised and regulated.
The speculators need to be in the markets. They have to be supervised. The farmers learned that at the turn of the 20th century. And in fact, the farmers are now upset because in the agriculture markets, the biggest investors are investment banks and hedge funds who are over-speculating and buying up contracts and driving the price through the roof.
Let's remind our listeners at 27 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And now to Rockingham, Vermont. Good morning, Harry. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Diane. I just heard that gentleman give a great discourse on the markets. I congratulate him. I am a trader. I'm on vacation, and I worry about the people in New England and along the coast freezing to death. But let me just say this. The gentleman knows about the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, and why don't they raise the margin requirements, which are now only 50%, make it 100% so those guys can't corral all those barrels of oil?
Explain what that means.
The margin, how much money do you have to put down to buy a contract? In the stock market, if you want to buy a stock, you at least have to put 50% down. By the way, in the futures markets, 5 to 7%.
Why?
Because the markets were invented for people who were doing business, farmers who needed insurance in these markets, and they didn't want to make farmers pay 50% of a contract. It's like buying a premium on an insurance policy. When you have Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs in these markets, there is legislation being readied that they should pay 25% or 50%. They're debating the thing. Speculators do not need to treat this like an insurance market.
Greg, where do you see that legislation going now?
Diane, I think that Michael raises some very good points about the opacity of these markets. In 2002, Enron was able to manipulate the electricity markets of California because it used these newfangled derivatives, which we had very little information on. The CFTC itself was blind to. So I think that in order to answer the question of whether there is manipulation going on, you need information. And I think Michael's made some excellent points about how our mere ability to actually look into these markets is moving away from us, and that's definitely something that policymakers would want to look at. On the question of whether you want to make it harder to speculate to increase margin requirements, I think Congress needs to be very careful, because when you make it harder to buy oil on margin, you will also make it harder to sell oil, and these markets are very good at matching up the buyers and sellers. And the existence of a fairly heavily traded futures market where buyers and sellers can actually contract to exchange oil as much as 6 years out is, at the margin, an incentive for people to go out and look for oil, because they may take several years to get it out of the ground, and they will be reassured that they can sell it and lock in the price 6 years forward. So that's just something that I think people need to be careful about.
Michael.
By the end of the month, there will be probably statistics out that 80% of the futures market is speculation, and 20% are people who are in the market trying to do business. The normal ratio is 2 to 1, 2 in business, 1 speculator. Many people in these markets believe these speculators could be driven out and that would be as liquid as it could be. By the by, there are many big oil companies who cannot hedge because these markets are out of control.
Let me refer to what U.S. Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson said he said intervention with regard to the dollar is not off the table. What does that mean?
Well, I think what he means that the dollar has been weakening, and conceivably at some point when it weakens, if it weakens a lot further, we, the United States, might sell foreign currency and buy dollars in order to show our support for the dollar, demonstrate support for the dollar. That operation is called intervention. And he wisely, in my view, said that we have not excluded that possibility. It is also true that it's not something that's been done at all by this administration, but it has been done, and it may well be done.
We'll take just a short break. When we come back, I want to talk about what the risks of that kind of intervention might be. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, by the David Bruce Smith Family Foundation, supporting humanitarian causes, by UVA's Miller Center, presenting a national debate, should illegal immigrants have a path to citizenship? Details are at millercenter.org, and by Miriam Muscarolis and Grant Abramson, thanking the donors to the NPR Foundation and councils for their support of NPR programming. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
How our increasingly mobile, multitasking, and virtual world may be eroding our willingness and ability to grapple with complex issues, and what this trend could mean for the strength of our democracy. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back. Just before the break, we were talking about the possibility, however slight, that Secretary of the Treasury Henry Paulson talked about intervention with the price of the U.S. dollar. What would the risks of that kind of intervention be, Michael Greenberger?
Well, that it wouldn't work and a lot of waters would be roiled. My own view is it's like pouring water down a hole because it ignores the fundamental problems that this country is experiencing. You want to tinker with the dollar. I go back to the point, it is my view, for whatever it's worth, that the dollar is weak because our oil prices are necessarily speculating up through the roof. Farm prices are speculating up through the roof. The subprime meltdown was because the Bush administration turned its back on regulating these complex derivatives. Mr. Geithner yesterday finally called for a regulatory structure. My view is, yes, intervene, but intervene by getting speculation under control, stopping these complex instruments, and balancing the budget.
Let's take a caller here in Washington, D.C. Good morning, Bill. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. I am a middle-class American, and I am a small-time investor. But I will say this. So based on the current economic situation, not just this nation, Diane, but of the global community,
yeah,
we have major crises coming. We already see social upheaval in several nations throughout the world because of the inflationary effects in the global community. I predict social upheaval in America. I would not be surprised in the next several years there will be martial law. It is a tragedy that we've gotten to this point within the community with the Wall Street playing a major role in selling a bunch of toxic financial instruments throughout the global community, that we now face a crisis of magnitude and proportions. And it is a tragedy, not just for America, but for the common people of the global community.
Thanks for calling, Bill. Greg Ip, do you want to comment?
You know, I think that while everybody, Democrats and Republicans and the public, would love to know that there were two or three simple things that could be done to correct this oil situation, I think everybody who's looked at it hard and cold realizes that there isn't. There are different policy approaches, but even if speculation is an important contributor to the run-up, a lot of it is supply and demand. And I would point out that with time, those things do work. People respond to prices. General Motors recently said that they were looking at revamping or selling their Hummer brand because people simply don't want to buy the vehicles any longer because their mileage is too poor. And we are seeing data that suggests that Americans actually are driving less. And over time, these higher prices will have the desired effect. People will consume less, and that explorers and companies will be inspired to look for more. But the transition to that period could take several years, and it could be very painful in the meantime. There are just no easy ways out here.
Here's an email from Alan at the University of Kentucky. Why are none of your guests addressing the role the war is playing in the monetary crisis, in that the massive loans required to finance the war required, combined with low interest rates, require that we give more dollars in exchange, and two, our military operations use a great deal of energy and further pressure the demand for oil? Michael Greenberger.
Well, I think that's the caller is absolutely right, and we should, as is said, we should bear that in mind. My own belief is that diverting $12 billion a month to this effort, which many people question whether it is making us safer, and rather than putting that into fixing our own infrastructure up, look, there are levees, for example, all over this country that people are worried about collapsing. It's just not New Orleans. It's Sacramento. Any major city you go to, people are worried about the levees. When you've got a country, oh, in fact, the levee at 17th and Constitution has been said not to be strong, and we may have flooding in downtown Washington. If the nation's capital gets flooded because of inadequate levees, you can't expect the U.S. dollar to remain the predominant financial instrument in the world.
Here's a very, very basic question from one of our listeners, Luis, who says, I'm a retiree in my 70s. The bulk of my financial assets are in money market funds with the major investment firms, Vanguard, Fidelity, Schwab, TR Price, etc. Should I be worried about their safety? Ted.
I think I would decline to defer to the regulators, but former regulator, the answer is that some of those funds, if I remember correctly, some of those funds are insured, but most of them are not. And if you want to be absolutely safe, you put your money in a FDIC-insured bank account.
Well, I'm not a financial advisor, and when people come and ask questions like that, I want to say that I can't and don't want to be responsible for that advice. The caller should call a financial advisor. Many money market funds are holding toxic subprime instruments, and there has been a fear that they would break the buck, which means that you always think the dollar you put in, the dollar you get back, your interest rate may vary. Several banks have had to take money from one part of the bank and put it into the money market funds so they don't cause a major panic. For example, this caller suddenly finding out that she's not going to get her dollars back. The buck has been broken. All I can say about that is this should be watched. I can't give financial advice, but I would go to financial advisors and ask the question, are the money markets my funds in, money markets that have toxic complex derivatives in it, thought to pump up the price and now valueless?
to Durham, North Carolina. Good morning, Ed. Ed, are you there in Durham, North Carolina?
Yes, I have two comments. Now, you started out on the value of the dollar,
sure.
And ended up in oil. Relative to the value of the dollar, I would say be careful what you wish for. I remember when Jimmy Carter was criticized for a weak dollar. At that time, 1.76, it would buy 1.76 Deutschmarks. And the feeling being that people didn't have any pride in the dollar. By the time the first Reagan administration was over, the dollar had almost doubled in value. You could buy 3.3 Deutschmarks, but home interest rates went from about 7 to 8% under Carter to 17% in the first Reagan administration. So be careful what you wish for. I think a weak dollar is fundamentally good for the American worker and the American economy. Relative to oil, I don't know why we worry about the price of oil. If I could do it and get by the auto and the oil lobbies, I would put a 20% tax on oil or its derivatives, such as gasoline, that were imported. And I would take 10% of that tax and put it towards paying down the national debt. I'd take the other 10% and put it into mass transportation, which would create a whole new industry. It would create jobs. It would be good for the economy.
Thanks for calling, Ed. Michael.
Well, it's one thing for us to decide as a nation we're going to tax ourselves and make gas more expensive and use the tax to better the country. Right now, it's my view, I think it's the view of George Soros and many others who've come to Congress, that extra money is going to homes in the Hamptons and not to improving our infrastructure. That is to say, we're paying speculators for this higher price rather than getting the money back as revenue. And with regard to being careful about the dollar got weak. It was supposed to help our exports for a while. It did. Today, I read Greg Ipp's wonderful paper, The Wall Street Journal, and our balance of payments are out of whack because of oil prices. I think Secretary Paulson would give his right sleeve, if not his right arm, to get this dollar strengthened. It's a very damaging to our economy, and if the dollar loses its preeminence, it will have consequences which will be very bad for all of us.
That's it.
Well, I think I agree with Michael broadly. I think you can't, as I like to say, you can't devalue your way to prosperity, and some people during the Carter administration felt that you could. And I think just to talk the dollar down or have it fine, unless you're doing other things to address your problem, become more competitive, you risk a disaster, which could double back and generate the same kind of very high interest rates that your caller talked about. I mean, in some sense, it was the mistakes that were made in the 70s that caused the high interest rates in the early 1980s.
Here's an email which begins, your guests were sleeping the day they taught the theory of monopolistic competition. The top three oil-producing countries are, 1, Saudi Arabia, a government monopoly, 2, Russia, Gazprom, effectively a government monopoly, and 3, the U.S., ExxonMobil, etc., oligopoly. The dollar as a world reserve currency has been on a long slide, serves as a benchmark for oil transactions. Every day the oil remains in the ground, these reserves increase in value. These monopolies and oligopolies get richer every day, enjoy a hedge against inflation and the eventual displacement of the U.S. dollar as a world reserve currency. There is no competition and no incentive to take reserves out of the ground. Michael?
I agree completely. There's no incentive to take reserves out of the ground or out of storage. But let me tell you, the oil companies are on their knees to Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, hedge funds. They're the ones that are controlling these markets.
What about Canada?
You know, that's a question I can't answer about Canada.
Ted, what about Canada?
I mean, it's oil company. It has a lot of oil, and it's been producing a lot of oil. Its oil is run by, if I remember, there are both the government is involved in some aspects of the of that in that production, but it has also smaller oil companies in it.
Let's go. Go ahead, Greg.
Sure. The caller actually made an excellent point. Now, more than ever, most of the untapped oil it belongs to countries where the oil production is controlled by government monopolies. And unlike most U.S. companies, they do not respond as readily to a rise in the price of oil. In fact, George Soros made this very point before Congress the other day, which is that in some cases, these countries might be inclined to produce less oil when the price goes up because they get the same number of dollars. Interestingly, Canada is probably one of the rare exceptions of a country that has a lot of oil available to be tapped, which has primarily got a private sector oil industry.
Now, what about the legislation the Democrats are pushing to tax the profits on the oil companies? Is that going to go anywhere? Is that just for lip service?
I think it has as good a chance to go anywhere as a lot of legislation that's pending.
Which is not very good.
No, I think that let me tell you, the gas prices have created lobbyists out of the American public at whole.
I hope so.
I can tell you from being on the Hill, they are hearing the message loud and clear, and there is a collective effort to want to do something. It's deciding what will be done. And I'm not opposed to windfall profit taxes, but I don't think that's going to solve the problem. The problem is going to be solved by knocking excessive speculation out of these markets.
At 7 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And now to Louisville, Kentucky. Good morning, Chris. You're on the air.
Good morning. Yeah, I am somewhat just frustrated because we are talking around the real problems. One of the speakers mentioned GM, and they're doing all they can do. Why don't we talk about having a mass viewing of the documentary Who Killed the Electric Car? Why can't we see why they took all of the EV1s? Not only did they not allow consumers to release them or buy them, they took them all off the market and destroyed them. We're talking about 30 more years of big money for big oil and the car companies. They won't make the changes necessary.
Greg Hipp.
Let's get some perspective here. It seems painful at the time, but let's go back to the severe oil shock of the early and late 1970s, is that it was shocking at the time. We had gas lines, partly because gasoline was rationed. But after a while, American consumers adapted. The economy became much more efficient. People used more natural gas, less heating oil. They bought smaller, more fuel-efficient cars. And I think that just shows us that given time, markets will work. And I think the economists of both sides of the spectrum who look at this carefully believe that the same thing will happen. The GM news on the Hummer, I think, is one sign of that. The soaring sales of hybrid vehicles and the enormous sums of money that venture capitalists in California and other places are pouring into alternative energy and plug-in cars. I certainly don't want to play down the seriousness of the situation we have with oil right now, Diane, but I do think that over time we're going to see some really meaningful changes in the way American consumers and businesses operate as a consequence of this higher oil price.
Not the same kind of threat we faced in the 70s, Michael.
Well, I think it's a completely different threat. I do think it was a supply-demand or a boycott threat, a cutting off of supply in the 70s. And, I have read an awful lot and looked an awful lot about this. There is a supply-demand problem, but it's not $140 a barrel.
So, clearly, both Senators McCain and Obama face huge problems as they go forward in this campaign. The American people are going to be asking them what kinds of steps they're going to take to fix these problems.
Absolutely. By the time, if we don't get out of this mess, by the time November rolls around, it's going to be the major issue. And there'll be a debate between drilling, which I think will do nothing because OPEC won't put oil into this market. It has no impact on it. And then the question will be whether we should get at speculation, whether we should have improved technology. But this will be a very hot topic unless gas prices drop.
Well, it's likely to be. I agree. It's likely to continue to be. We're not going to be out of this by November, right? As Greg said, this is a long-term. Getting out of this will be a long-term problem, meaning lasting at least the next administration.
Ted Truman of the Peterson Institute of International Economics, Michael Greenberger, professor at the University of Maryland Law School, and Greg Ipp of the Wall Street Journal. Thank you all for a most enlightening conversation. Thanks for listening, everybody. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, and Tanya Weinberg, with help from Susan Neighbors. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from Softscribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.